for it sat upright next to a portable plastic kiddie swimming pool. And in Dallas, he had watched the investigators on the rooftops of the suburban houses collecting the body parts, putting them in bags. Working on a crash site team demanded the most extraordinary psychological vigilance to avoid being overwhelmed by what you saw. But there was never any personal danger, any physical risk. The risk was the risk of nightmares. But now, the prospect of going down 1,000 feet under the ocean to investigate a wreck. "You okay?" Beth said. "You look pale." "I didn't know anybody was talking about going down there." "Just rumors," Beth said. "Get some rest, Norman. I think you need it." The briefing. The ULF team met in the briefing room just before 11. Norman was interested to see the group he had picked 6 years before, now assembled together for the first time. Ted Fielding was compact, handsome, and still boyish at 40, at ease in shorts and a polo sport shirt. An astrophysicist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, he had done important work on the planetary stratigraphy of Mercury and the Moon, although he was best known for his studies of the Mangala Vallis and Valles Marineris channels on Mars. Located at the Martian equator, these great canyons were as much as 2,500 miles long and 2.5 miles deep, 10 times the length and twice the depth of the Grand Canyon. And Fielding had been among the first to conclude that the planet most like the Earth in composition was not Mars at all, as previously suspected, but tiny Mercury, with its Earth-like magnetic field. Fielding's manner was open, cheerful, and pompous. At JPL, he had appeared on television whenever there was a spacecraft flyby, and thus enjoyed a certain celebrity. He had recently been remarried to a television weather reporter in Los Angeles. They had a young son. Ted was a long-standing advocate for life on other worlds and a supporter of SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, which other scientists considered a waste of time and money. He grinned happily at Norman now. "I always knew this would happen. Sooner or later, we'd get our proof of intelligent life on other worlds. Now, at last, we have it, Norman. This is a great moment, and I'm especially pleased about the shape." "The shape?" "Of the object down there." "What about it?" Norman hadn't heard anything about the shape. "I've been in the monitor room watching the video feed from the robots. They're beginning to define the shape beneath the coral, and it's not round. It is not a flying saucer," Ted said. "Thank God. Perhaps this will silence the lunatic fringe." He smiled. "All things come to him who waits, eh?" "I guess so," Norman said. He wasn't sure what Fielding meant, but Ted tended to literary quotations. Ted saw himself as a Renaissance man, and random quotations from Rousseau and Lao Tzu were one way to remind you of it. Yet there was nothing mean-spirited about him. Someone once said that Ted was a brand-name guy, and that carried over to his speech as well. There was an innocence, almost a naivete, to Ted Fielding that was endearing and genuine. Norman liked him. He wasn't so sure about Harry Adams, the reserved Princeton mathematician Norman hadn't seen for 6 years. Harry was now a tall, very thin black man with wire-framed glasses and a perpetual frown. He wore a T-shirt that said, "Mathematicians do it correctly." It was the kind of thing a student would wear, and indeed, Adams appeared even younger than his 30 years. He was clearly the youngest member of the group, and arguably the most important. Many theorists argued that communication with extraterrestrials would prove impossible, because human beings would have nothing in common with them. These thinkers pointed out that just as human bodies represented the outcome of many evolutionary events, so did human thought. Like our bodies, our ways of thinking could easily have turned out differently. There was nothing inevitable about how we looked at the universe. Men already had trouble communicating with intelligent earthly creatures, such as dolphins, simply because dolphins lived in such a different environment and had such different sensory apparatus. Yet men and dolphins might appear virtually identical when compared with the vast differences that separated us from an extraterrestrial creature, a creature who was the product of billions of years of divergent evolution in some other planetary environment, Such an extraterrestrial would be unlikely to see the world as we did. In fact, it might not see the world at all. It might be blind. And it might learn about the world through a highly developed sense of smell, or temperature, or pressure. There might be no way to communicate with such a creature. No common ground at all. As one man put it, how would you explain Wordsworth's poem about daffodils to a blind water snake? But the field of knowledge we were most likely to share with extraterrestrials was mathematics. So the team mathematician was going to play a crucial role. Norman had selected Adams because, despite his youth, Harry had already made important contributions to several different fields. "What do you think about all this, Harry?" Norman said, dropping into a chair next to him. "I think it's perfectly clear," Harry said, "that it is a waste of time." "This fin they found underwater?" "I don't know what it is, but I know what it isn't. It isn't a spacecraft from another civilization." Ted, standing nearby, turned away in annoyance. Harry and Ted had evidently had this same conversation already. "How do you know?" Norman asked. "A simple calculation," Harry said, with a dismissing wave of his hand. "Trivial, really. You know the Drake equation?" Norman did. It was one of the famous proposals in the literature on extraterrestrial life. But he said, "Refresh me." Harry sighed irritably, pulled out a sheet of paper. "It's a probability equation." He wrote, "P equals F sub P, N sub H, F sub L, F sub I, F sub C." "What it means," Harry Adams said, "is that the probability, P, that intelligent life will evolve in any star system is a function of the probability that the star will have planets, the number of habitable planets, the probability that simple life will evolve on a habitable planet, the probability that intelligent life will evolve from simple life, and the probability that intelligent life will attempt interstellar communication within 5 billion years. That's all the equation says." "Uh-huh," Norman said. "But the point is that we have no facts," Harry said. "We must guess at every single one of these probabilities. And it's quite easy to guess one way, as Ted does, and conclude there are probably thousands of intelligent civilizations. It's equally easy to guess, as I do, that there is probably only one civilization, ours." He pushed the paper away. "And in that case, whatever is down there is not from an alien civilization, so we're all wasting our time here." "Then what is down there?" Norman said again. "It is an absurd expression of romantic hope," Adams said, pushing his glasses up on his nose. There was a vehemence about him that troubled Norman. 6 years earlier, Harry Adams had still been a street kid whose obscure talent had carried him in a single step from a broken home in the slums of Philadelphia to the manicured green lawns of Princeton. In those days, Adams had been playful, amused at his turn of fortune. Why was he so harsh now? Adams was an extraordinarily gifted theoretician. His reputation, secured in probability-density functions of quantum mechanics which were beyond Norman's comprehension, although Adams had worked them out when he was 17. But Norman could certainly understand the man himself, and Harry Adams seemed tense and critical now, ill at ease in this group. Or perhaps it had to do with his presence as part of a group. Norman had worried about how he would fit in because Harry had been a child prodigy. There were really only two kinds of child prodigies, mathematical and musical. Some psychologists argued there was only one kind, since music was so closely related to mathematics, while there were precocious children with other talents, such as writing, painting, and athletics. The only areas in which a child might truly perform at the level of an adult were in mathematics or music. Psychologically, such children were complex, often loners, isolated from their peers and even from their families by their gifts, for which they were both admired and resented. Socialization skills were often retarded, making group interactions uncomfortable. As a slum kid, Harry's problems would have been, if anything, magnified. He had once told Norman that when he first learned about Fourier transforms, the other kids were learning to slam dunk. So maybe Harry was feeling uncomfortable in the group now. But there seemed to be something else. Harry appeared almost angry.
You wait,
Adam said. A week from now, this is going to be recognized as one big fat false alarm, nothing more. You hope, Norman thought, and again wondered why. Well, I think it's exciting, Beth Halpern said, smiling brightly. Even a slim chance of finding new life is exciting, as far as I'm concerned. That's right, Ed said. After all, Harry, there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamed of in your philosophy. Norman looked over at the final member of the team, Arthur Levine, the marine biologist. Levine was the only person he didn't know. A pudgy man, Levine looked pale and uneasy, wrapped in his own thoughts. He was about to ask Levine what he thought when Captain Barnes strode in, a stack of files under his arm. Welcome to the middle of nowhere, Barnes said, and you can't even go to the bathroom. They all laughed nervously. Sorry to keep you waiting, he said, but we don't have a lot of time, so let's get right down to it. If you'll kill the lights, we can begin. The first slide showed a large ship with an elaborate superstructure on the stern. The Rose Sea Lady, Barnes said, a cable-laying vessel chartered by Transpac Communications to lay a submarine telephone line from Honolulu to Sydney, Australia. The Rose left Hawaii on May 29th of this year, and by June 16th it had gotten as far as Western Samoa in the mid-Pacific. It was laying a new fiber optics cable, which has a carrying capacity of 20,000 simultaneous telephonic transmissions. The cable is covered with a dense metal and plastics web matrix, unusually tough and resistant to breaks. The ship had already laid more than 4,600 nautical miles of cable across the Pacific with no mishaps of any sort. Next, a map of the Pacific with a large red spot. At 10 p.m. on the night of June 17th, the vessel was located here, midway between Pongo Pongo in American Samoa and Viti Levu in Fiji, when the ship experienced a wrenching shudder. Alarm sounded, and the crew realized the cable had snagged and torn. They immediately consulted their charts, looking for an underwater obstruction, but could see none. They hauled up the loose cable, which took several hours, since at the time of the accident they had more than a mile of cable paid out behind the ship. When they examined the cut end, they saw that it had been cleanly sheared, as one crewman said, like it was cut with a huge pair of scissors. Next, a section of fiberglass cable held toward the camera in the rough hand of a sailor. The nature of the break, as you can see, suggests an artificial obstruction of some sort. The Rose steamed north back over the scene of the break. Next, a series of ragged black and white lines with a region of small spikes. This is the original sonar scan from the ship. If you can't read sonar scans, this will be hard to interpret, but you see here the thin, knife-edge obstruction, consistent with a sunken ship or aircraft which cut the cable. The charter company, Transpac Communications, notified the Navy, requesting any information we had about the obstruction. This is routine. Whenever there is a cable break, the Navy is notified, on the chance that the obstruction is known to us. If it's a sunken vessel containing explosives, the cable company wants to know about it before they start repair. But in this case, the obstruction was not on Navy files, and the Navy was interested. We immediately dispatched our nearest search ship, the Ocean Explorer, from Melbourne. The Ocean Explorer reached the site on June 21st of this year. The reason for the Navy interest was the possibility that the obstruction might represent a sunken Chinese Wuhan-class nuclear submarine fitted with SY-2 missiles. We knew the Chinese lost such a sub in this approximate area in May 1984. The Ocean Explorer scanned the bottom using a most sophisticated side-looking sonar, which produced this picture of the bottom. In color, the image was almost three-dimensional in its clarity. As you see, the bottom appears flat except for a single triangular fin, which sticks up some 280 feet above the ocean floor. You see it here, he said, pointing. Now, this wing dimension is larger than any known aircraft manufactured in either the United States or the Soviet Union. This was very puzzling at first. Next. A submersible robot being lowered on a crane over the side of a ship. The robot looked like a series of horizontal tubes with cameras and lights nestled in the center. By June 24th, the Navy had the ROV carrier Neptune 4 on site, and the remote-operated vehicle Scorpion, which you see here, was sent down to photograph the wing. It returned an image that clearly showed a control surface of some sort. Here it is. There were murmurs from the group. In a harshly lit color image, a gray fin stuck up from a flat coral floor. The fin was sharp-edged and aeronautical-looking, tapered, definitely artificial. "You'll notice," Barnes said, "that the sea bottom in this region consists of scrubby dead coral. The wing or fin disappears into the coral, suggesting the rest of the aircraft might be buried beneath." An ultra-high-resolution SLS bottom scan was carried out to detect the shape underneath the coral. Next, another color sonar image composed of fine dots instead of lines. As you see, the fin seems to be attached to a cylindrical object buried under the coral. The object has a diameter of 190 feet and extends west for a distance of 2,754 feet before tapering to a point. More murmurings from the audience. "That's correct," Barnes said. "The cylindrical object is half a mile long. The shape is consistent with a rocket or spacecraft. It certainly looks like that. But from the beginning, we were careful to refer to this object as the anomaly." Norman glanced over at Ted, who was smiling up at the screen. But alongside Ted in the darkness, Harry Adams frowned and pushed his glasses up on his nose. Then the projector light went out. The room was plunged into darkness. There were groans. Norman heard Barnes say, "God damn it, not again." Someone scrambled for the door. There was a rectangle of light. Beth leaned over to Norman and said, "They lose power here all the time. Reassuring, huh?" Moments later, the electricity came back on. Barnes continued. "On June 25th, the Scarab remote vehicle cut a piece from the tail fin and brought it to the surface. The fin segment was analyzed and found to be a titanium alloy in an epoxy resin honeycomb, the necessary bonding technology for such metal plastic materials was currently unknown on Earth. Experts confirmed that the fin could not have originated on this planet, although in 10 or 20 years we'd probably know how to make it." Harry Adams grunted, leaned forward, made a note on his pad. Meanwhile, Barnes explained other robot vessels were used to plant seismic charges on the bottom. Seismic analysis showed that the buried anomaly was of metal, that it was hollow, and that it had a complex internal structure. After 2 weeks of intensive study, Barnes said, "We concluded the anomaly was some sort of spacecraft." The final verification came on June 27th from the geologists. Their core samples from the bottom indicated that the present seabed had formerly been much shallower, perhaps only 80 or 90 feet deep. This would explain the coral, which covered the craft to an average thickness of 30 feet. Therefore, the geologists said, the craft had been on the planet at least 300 years, and perhaps much longer, 500 or even 5,000 years. However reluctantly, Barnes said, the Navy concluded that we had in fact found a spacecraft from another civilization. The decision of the President, before a special meeting of the National Security Council, was to open the spacecraft. So, starting June 29th, the ULF team members were called in. On July 1st, the subsea habitat, DH-7, was lowered into position near the spacecraft site. DH-7 housed 9 Navy divers working in a saturated exotic gas environment. They proceeded to do primary drilling work. "And I think that brings you up to date," Barnes said. "Any questions?" Ted said, "The internal structure of the spacecraft, has it been clarified?" "Not at this point. The spacecraft seems to be built in such a way that shock waves are transmitted around the outer shell, which is tremendously strong and well-engineered. That prevents a clear picture of the interior from the seismics." "How about passive techniques to see what's inside?" "We've tried," Barnes said. "Gravitometric analysis, negative. Thermography, negative. Resistivity mapping, negative. Proton precision magnetometers, negative. Listening devices?" "We've had hydrophones on the bottom from day one. There have been no sounds emanating from the craft, at least not so far." "What about other remote inspection procedures?" Most involve radiation and were hesitant to irradiate the craft at this time. Harry said, Captain Barnes, I noticed the fin appears undamaged and the hull appears a perfect cylinder. Do you think that this object crashed in the ocean? Yes, Barnes said, looking uneasy. So this object has survived a high-speed impact with the water without a scratch or a dent? Well, it's tremendously strong. Harry nodded. It would have to be. Beth said, the divers who are down there now, what exactly are they doing? Looking for the front door. Barnes smiled. For the time being, we've had to fall back on classical archaeological procedures. We're digging exploratory trenches in the coral, looking for an entrance or a hatch of some kind. We hope to find it within the next 24 to 48 hours. Once we do, you're going in. Anything else? Yes, Ted said. What was the Russian reaction to this discovery? We haven't told the Russians, Barnes said. You haven't told them? No, we haven't. But this is an incredible, unprecedented development in human history. Not just American history, human history. Surely we should share this with all the nations of the world. This is the sort of discovery that could unite all of mankind. You'd have to speak to the president, Barnes said. I don't know the reasoning behind it, but it's his decision. Any other questions? Nobody said anything. The team looked at each other. Then I guess that's it, Barnes said. The lights came on. There was the scraping of chairs as people stood, stretched. Then Harry Adams said, Captain Barnes, I must say I resent this briefing very much. Barnes looked surprised. What do you mean, Harry? The other stopped, looked at Adams. He remained seated in his chair, an irritated look on his face. Did you decide you have to break the news to us gently? What news? The news about the door. Barnes laughed uneasily. Harry, I just got through telling you that the divers are cutting exploratory trenches looking for the door. I'd say you had a pretty good idea where the door was 3 days ago, when you started flying us in. And I'd say that by now you probably know exactly where the door is. Am I right? Barnes said nothing. He stood with a fixed smile on his face. My God, Norman thought, looking at Barnes. Harry's right. Harry was known to have a superbly logical brain, an astonishing and cold deductive ability, but Norman had never seen him at work. Yes, Barnes said finally. You're right. You know the location of the door? We do, yes. There was a moment of silence, and then Ted said, But this is fantastic, absolutely fantastic. When will we go down there to enter the spacecraft? Tomorrow, Barnes said, never taking his eyes off Harry. And Harry, for his own part, stared fixedly at Barnes. The mini-subs will take you down in pairs, starting at 0800 hours tomorrow morning. This is exciting, Ted said. Fantastic. Unbelievable. So, Barnes said, still watching Harry, you should all get a good night's sleep, if you can.
Innocent sleep, sleep that knits up the raveled sleeve of care, Ted said. He was literally bobbing up and down in his chair with excitement.
During the rest of the day, supply and technical officers will be coming to measure and outfit you. Any other questions, Barnes said, you can find me in my office. He left the room, and the meeting broke up. When the others filed out, Norman remained behind with Harry Adams. Harry never moved from his chair. He watched the technician packing up the portable screen.
That was quite a performance just now, Norman said.
Was it? I don't see why.
You deduced that Barnes wasn't telling us about the door.
Oh, there's much more he's not telling us about, Adams said in a cold voice. He's not telling us about any of the important things.
Like what?
Like the fact, Harry said, getting to his feet at last, that Captain Barnes knows perfectly well why the President decided to keep this a secret.
He does?
The President had no choice under the circumstances.
What circumstances?
He knows that the object down there is not an alien spacecraft.
Then what is it?
I think it's quite clear what it is.
Not to me, Norman said.
Adam smiled for the first time. It was a thin smile, entirely without humor. You wouldn't believe it if I told you, he said. And he left the room.
Tests.
Arthur Levine, the marine biologist, was the only member of the expedition Norman Johnson had not met. It was one of the things we hadn't planned for, he thought. Norman had assumed that any contact with unknown life would occur on land. He hadn't considered the most obvious possibility, that if a spacecraft landed at random somewhere on the Earth, it would most likely come down on water, since 70% of the planet was covered with water. It was obvious in retrospect that they would need a marine biologist. What else, he wondered, would prove obvious in retrospect? He found Levine hanging off the port railing. Levine came from the Oceanographic Institute at Woods Hole, Massachusetts. His hand was damp when Norman shook it. Levine looked extremely ill at ease and finally admitted that he was seasick. Seasick? A marine biologist? Norman said.
I work in the laboratory, he said.
At home, on land,
where things don't move all the time.
Why are you smiling?
Sorry, Norman said. You think it's funny? A seasick marine biologist?
Incongruous, I guess.
A lot of us get seasick,
Levine said. He stared out at the sea.
Look out there,
he said.
Thousands of miles of flat. Nothing.
The ocean.
It gives me the creeps, Levine said.
So, Barnes said back in his office, what do you think?
Of what?
Of the team, for Christ's sake. It's the team I chose 6 years later. Basically a good group. Certainly very able. I want to know who will crack.
Why should anybody crack? Norman said.
He was looking at Barnes, noticing the thin line of sweat on his upper lip. The commander was under a lot of pressure himself. 1,000 feet down, Barnes said. Living and working in a cramped habitat? Listen, it's not like I'm going in with military divers who have been trained and who have themselves under control. I'm taking a bunch of scientists, for God's sake. I want to make sure they all have a clean bill of health. I want to make sure nobody's going to crack.
I don't know if you are aware of this, Captain, but psychologists can't predict that very accurately.
Who will crack? Even when it's from fear?
Whatever it's from.
Barnes frowned. I thought fear was your specialty. Anxiety is one of my research interests, and I can tell you who, on the basis of personality profiles, is likely to suffer acute anxiety in a stress situation. But I can't predict who will crack under that stress and who won't.
Then what good are you?
Barnes said irritably. He sighed.
I am sorry. Don't you just want to interview them or give them some tests?
There aren't any tests, Norman said, at least none that work. Barnes sighed again.
What about Levine?
He's seasick.
There isn't any motion underwater. That won't be a problem. But what about him personally?
I'd be concerned, Norman said.
Duly noted. What about Harry Adams? He's arrogant.
Yes, Norman said. But that's probably desirable. Studies had shown that the people who were most successful at handling pressure were people others didn't like, individuals who were described as arrogant, cocksure, irritating.
Maybe so, Barnes said.
But what about his famous research paper? Harry was one of the biggest supporters of SETI a few years back. Now that we've found something, he's suddenly very negative. You remember his paper?
Norman didn't, and was about to say so, when an ensign came in.
Captain Barnes, here's the visual upgrade you wanted.
Okay, Barnes said. He squinted at a photograph, put it down.
What about the weather?
No change, sir. Satellite reports are confirming we have 48 plus minus 12 on site, sir.
Hell, Barnes said.
Trouble?
Norman asked.
The weather's going bad on us,
Barnes said.
We may have to clear out our surface support.
Does that mean you'll cancel going down there?
No, Barnes said. We go tomorrow as planned.
Why does Harry think this thing is not a spacecraft? Norman asked.
Barnes frowned, pushed papers on his desk.
Let me tell you something, he said. Harry's a theoretician, and theories are just that, theories. I deal in the hard facts. The fact is, we've got something damn old and damn strange down there. I want to know what it is.
But if it's not an alien spacecraft, what is it?
Let's just wait until we get down there, shall we? Barnes glanced at his watch. The second habitat should be anchored on the seafloor by now. We'll begin moving you down in 15 hours. Between now and then, we've all got a lot to do.
Just hold it there, Dr. Johnson. Norman stood naked, felt two metal calipers pinch the back of his arms, just above the elbow. Just a bit. That's fine. Now you can get into the tank. The young medical corpsman stepped aside, and Norman climbed the steps to the metal tank, which looked like a military version of a jacuzzi. The tank was filled to the top with water. As he lowered his body into the water, it spilled over the sides. "What's all this for?" Norman asked. "I'm sorry, Dr. Johnson. If you would completely immerse yourself..."
"What?"
"Just for a moment, sir." Norman took a breath, ducked under the water, came back up. "That's fine. You can get out now," the corpsman said, handing him a towel. "What's all this for?" he asked again, climbing down the ladder. "Total body adipose content," the corpsman said. "We have to know it to calculate your sat stats."
"My sat stats?"
"Your saturation statistics." The corpsman marked points on his clipboard.
"Oh, dear," he said.
"You're off the graph."
"Why is that?"
"Do you get much exercise, Dr. Johnson?"
"Some."
He was feeling defensive now, and the towel was too small to wrap around his waist.
"Why did the Navy use such small towels?"
"Do you drink?"
"Some."
He was feeling distinctly defensive, no question about it.
"May I ask when you last consumed an alcoholic beverage, sir?"
"I don't know, 2-3 days ago. He was having trouble thinking back to San Diego. It seemed so far away.
"Why?"
"That's fine, Dr. Johnson. Any trouble with joints, hips, or knees?"
"No, why?"
"Episodes of syncope, faintness, or blackouts?"
"No."
"If you would just sit over here, sir." The corpsman pointed to a stool next to an electronic device on the wall.
"I'd really like some answers," Norman said.
"Just stare at the green dot, both eyes wide open." He felt a brief blast of air on both eyes and blinked instinctively. A printed strip of paper clicked out. The corpsman tore it off, glanced at it.
"That's fine, Dr. Johnson. If you would come this way..."
"I'd like some information from you," Norman said. "I'd like to know what's going on."
"I understand, sir, but I have to finish your workup in time for your next briefing at 1700 hours.
Norman lay on his back, and technicians stuck needles in both arms and another in his leg at the groin. He yelled in sudden pain.
"That's the worst of it, sir," the corpsman said, packing the syringes in ice. "If you'll just press this cotton against it here..."
There was a clip over his nostrils, a mouthpiece between his teeth.
"This is to measure your CO2, the corpsman said.
"Just exhale."
"That's right.
Big breath.
Now exhale."
Norman exhaled. He watched a rubber diaphragm inflate, pushing a needle up a scale.
"Try it again, sir. I'm sure you can do better than that."
Norman didn't think he could, but he tried again anyway. Another corpsman entered the room with a sheet of paper covered with figures.
"Here is BC's," he said.
The first corpsman frowned.
"Has Barnes seen this?"
"Yes."
"And what did he say?"
"He said it was okay. He said to continue."
"Okay, fine. He's the boss."
The first corpsman turned back to Norman.
"Let's try one more big breath, Dr. Johnson, if you would."
Metal calipers touched his chin and his forehead. A tape went around his head. Now the calipers measured from his ear to his chin.
"What's this for?" Norman said.
"Fitting you with the helmet, sir."
"Shouldn't I be trying one on?"
"This is the way we do it, sir."
Dinner was macaroni and cheese burned underneath. Norman pushed it aside after a few bites. The corpsman appeared at his door.
"Time for the 1700 hours briefing, sir."
"I'm not going anywhere," Norman said, "until I get some answers. What the hell is all this you're doing to me?"
"Routine deep-set workup, sir. Navy regs require it before you go down."
"And why am I off the graph?"
"Sorry, sir?"
"You said I was off the graph."
"Oh, that. You're a bit heavier than the Navy tables figure for, sir."
Is there a problem about my weight?
Shouldn't be. No, sir.
And the other tests, what did they show?
Sir, you are in very good health for your age and lifestyle.
And what about going down there? Norman asked, half hoping he wouldn't be able to go.
Down there? I've talked with Captain Barnes. Shouldn't be any problem at all, sir. If you'll just come this way to the briefing, sir.
The others were sitting around in the briefing room, with styrofoam cups of coffee. Norman felt glad to see them. He dropped into a chair next to Harry.
Jesus, did you have the damn physical?
Yeah, he said. Had it yesterday. They stuck me in the leg with this long needle, Norman said.
Really? They didn't do that to me.
And how about breathing with that clip on your nose?
I didn't do that either, Harry said. Sounds like you got some special treatment, Norman.
Norman was thinking the same thing, and he didn't like the implications. He felt suddenly tired.
All right, men. We've got a lot to cover and just 3 hours to do it, a brisk man said, turning off the lights as he came into the room.
Norman hadn't even gotten a good look at him. Now it was just a voice in the dark.
As you know, Dalton's law governs partial pressures of mixed gases, or, as represented here in algebraic form, the first of the graphs flashed up.
PP sub A equals P sub total times percent volume sub A.
Now let's review how calculation of the partial pressure might be done in atmospheres absolute, which is the most common procedure we employ.
The words were meaningless to Norman. He tried to pay attention, but as the graphs continued and the voice droned on, his eyes grew heavier and he fell asleep.
Be taken down in the submarine, and once in the habitat module, you will be pressurized to 33 atmospheres. At that time, we will be switched over to mixed gases, since it is not possible to breathe Earth atmosphere beyond 18 atmospheres.
Norman stopped listening. These technical details only filled him with dread. He went back to sleep, awakening only intermittently.
Since oxygen toxicity only occurs when the PO2 exceeds 0.7 ATA for prolonged periods,
nitrogen narcosis, in which nitrogen behaves like an anesthetic, will occur in mixed gas atmospheres if partial pressures exceeds 1.5 ATA in the DDS. Demand open circuit is generally preferable, but you will be using semi-closed circuit with inspired fluctuations of 608 to 760 millimeters.
He went back to sleep.
When it was over, they walked back to their rooms.
Did I miss anything? Norman said.
Not really, Harry shrugged. Just a lot of physics.
In his tiny gray room, Norman got into bed. The glowing wall clock said 2300. It took him a while to figure out that that was 11 p.m. In 9 more hours, he thought, I will begin the descent. Then he slept. The Deep Descent. In the morning light, the submarine Karen 5 bobbed on the surface, riding on a pontoon platform. Bright yellow, it looked like a child's bathtub toy sitting on a deck of oil drums. A rubber Zodiac launch took Norman over, and he climbed onto the platform, shook hands with the pilot, who could not have been more than 18, younger than his son, Tim.
Ready to go, sir?
The pilot said.
Sure, Norman said. He was as ready as he would ever be.
Up close, the sub did not look like a toy. It was incredibly massive and strong. Norman saw a single porthole of curved acrylic. It was held in place by bolts as big as his fist. He touched them tentatively. The pilot smiled.
Want to kick the tires, sir?
No, I'll trust you.
Ladders this way, sir.
Norman climbed the narrow rungs to the top of the sub and saw the small circular hatch opening. He hesitated.
Sit on the edge here, the pilot said, and drop your legs in, then follow it down. You may have to squeeze your shoulders together a bit and suck in your...
That's it, sir. Norman wriggled through the tight hatch into an interior so low he could not stand. The sub was crammed with dials and machinery. Ted was already aboard, hunched in the back, grinning like a kid.
Isn't this fantastic?
Norman envied his easy enthusiasm. He felt cramped and a little nervous. Above him, the pilot clanged the heavy hatch shut and dropped down to take the controls.
Everybody okay?
They nodded.
Sorry about the view, the pilot said, glancing over his shoulders. You gentlemen are mostly going to be seeing my hindquarters. Let's get started. Mozart okay?
He pressed the tape deck and smiled.
We've got 13 minutes to descend to the bottom. Music makes it a little easier. If you don't like Mozart, we can offer you something else.
Mozart's fine, Norman said.
Mozart's wonderful, Ted said. Sublime.
Very good, gentlemen.
The submarine hissed. There was squawking on the radio. The pilot spoke softly into a headset. A scuba diver appeared at the porthole, waved. The pilot waved back. There was a sloshing sound, then a deep rumble, and they started down.
As you see, the whole sled goes under, the pilot explained. The sub's not stable on the surface, so we sled her up and down. We'll leave the sled at about 100 feet or so.
Through the porthole, they saw the diver standing on the deck, the water now waist deep. Then the water covered the porthole. Bubbles came out of the diver's scuba.
We're under, the pilot said.
He adjusted valves above his head, and they heard the hiss of air, startlingly loud, more gurgling. The light in the submarine from the porthole was a beautiful blue.
Lovely, Ted said.
We'll leave the sled now, the pilot said.
Motors rumbled, and the sub moved forward, the diver slipping off to one side. Now there was nothing to be seen through the porthole but undifferentiated blue water. The pilot said something on the radio and turned up the Mozart.
Just sit back, gentlemen, he said. Descending 80 feet a minute.
Norman felt the rumble of the electric motors, but there was no real sense of motion. All that happened was that it got darker and darker.
You know, Ted said, we're really quite lucky about this site. Most parts of the Pacific are so deep we'd never be able to visit it in person.
He explained that the vast Pacific Ocean, which amounted to half the total surface area of the Earth, had an average depth of 2 miles. There are only a few places where it is less. One is the relatively small rectangle bounded by Samoa, New Zealand, Australia, and New Guinea, which is actually a great undersea plain, like the plains of the American West, except it's at an average depth of 2,000 feet. That's what we are doing now, descending to that plain.
Ted spoke rapidly. Was he nervous?
Norman couldn't tell. He was feeling his own heart pound. Now it was quite dark outside. The instruments glowed green. The pilot flicked on red interior lights. Their descent continued.
400 feet.
The submarine lurched, then eased forward.
This is the river.
What river? Norman said.
Sir, we are in a current of different salinity and temperature. It behaves like a river inside the ocean. We traditionally stop about here, sir. The sub sticks in the river, takes us for a little ride.
Oh, yes, Ted said, reaching into his pocket. Ted handed the pilot a $10 bill. Norman glanced questioningly at Ted.
Didn't they mention that to you?
Old tradition. You always pay the pilot on your way down for good luck. I can use some luck, Norman said. He fumbled in his pocket. Found a $5 bill, thought better of it, took out a 20 instead.
Thank you, gentlemen, and have a good bottom stay, both of you, the pilot said.
The electric motors cut back in. The descent continued. The water was dark.
500 feet, he said. Halfway there.
The submarine creaked loudly, then made several explosive pops. Norman was startled.
That's normal pressure adjustment, the pilot said. No problem.
Uh-huh. Norman said. He wiped sweat on his shirt sleeve. It seemed that the interior of the submarine was now much smaller, the walls closer to his face.
Actually, Ted said, if I remember, this particular region of the Pacific is called the Lao Basin, isn't that right?
That's right, sir, the Lao Basin.
It's a plateau between two undersea ridges, the South Fiji, or Lao Ridge, to the west, and the Tonga Ridge to the east.
That's correct, Dr. Fielding.
Norman glanced at the instruments. They were covered with moisture. The pilot had to rub the dials with a cloth to read them. Was the sub leaking? No, he thought, just condensation. The interior of the submarine was growing colder. Take it easy, he told himself.
800 feet,
the pilot said. It was now completely black outside.
This is very exciting, Ted said.
Have you ever done anything like this before, Norman?
No, Norman said.
Me neither,
Ted said.
What a thrill.
Norman wished he would shut up.
You know, Ted said, when we open this alien craft up and make our first contact with another form of life, it's going to be a great moment in the history of our species on Earth.
I've been wondering about what we should say,